Hey, podcast listeners, Michael Shelley here. Just want to let you know that we are in the middle of our autumn fundraiser. We try to make this one not such a big deal. But I do want to just remind you, you can pledge to WFMU, especially if you never have. Now's a great time to get on board. Go to WFMU.org/Michael. At the top of the page, you'll see what we call the pledge widget, and it takes you a few seconds to pledge. There's some new t-shirts and stuff that we'll give back to you. And it's also a great chance to get a copy of more super hits of the 70s, that great CD that we made available last year to folks who pledged to this program. So take a look at WFMU.org/Michael. All right, today's guest, Dennis McNally. He wrote a very interesting book. We'll talk all about it here. Next week is Deke Dickerson, Holly George Warren, Alex Chilton biographer. The week after that, I believe it's all over there, WFMU.org/Michael. That's it. Thanks.
I love that song. That song is a number one hit, as far as I'm concerned. All right, joining us on the telephone, Dennis McNally, welcome to the program. How are you?
I am just fine. Good morning.
Good morning. So I read the book, and in the course of doing this show, I read lots and lots of books about music, and they're usually very straightforward to describe what they're about. They're usually just a biography of a person or a band or a little piece of music history, an investigation on what that, you know, contribution to music is. But this book is much harder to describe. And eventually, and you tell me if I'm right, it's really about how African-American music and white music have crisscrossed and produced Bob Dylan, sort of, in the end. Is that sort of what the book is about?
Among other things, yeah. In essence, it's the deepest roots of rock and roll, because what it's about is the interplay between white music and white people and their reception of black music, going all the way back to the minstrel era. And for me, the guy that sort of sums it all up best, and the guy who makes rock and roll, who makes some of the most interesting rock and roll of the mid-60s, is Dylan. And he sort of, all of the different streams of this book, which include sort of the impulse to lead people towards spiritual freedom, going all the way back to Thoreau and Mark Twain, and the spirituals, for instance, and because he was deeply involved with the civil rights movement. And then, in addition, just playing musically, he is the guy who, as he put it in his album, bringing it all back home, you know, he returned to rock and roll, which had been his high school thing, and really is where black people and white people met musically.
It's a fascinating book, and it does sort of just tell, in some ways, just the history of the United States of America, at least sort of a very interesting slice of it. And like you said, you start with Thoreau, and you go to Mark Twain, and the beginning of jazz in New Orleans, and blues in the Mississippi Delta, and ragtime, and bebop, and rock and roll, and, you know, Bill Haley, and all these things come together, and finally, you sort of do sort of show the line of how it gets to Bob Dylan. Sometimes, one of the problems with books like this often, and this book does not have this problem, is that for authors, or people who are trying to intellectualize culture, they're looking backwards. So it's so easy to connect dots when you're looking backwards. But in this book, it's almost like you've put yourself in the past and then are looking forward to, you know, if that makes sense?
It does. Thank you. I'll take that as a great compliment, because it's true. I mean, all history is written backwards. You know, if you study history as a what they call historiography, you end up realizing most histories reflect more of the time they're written than necessarily anything else. And, you know, so the 1950s, there was this whole theory that there really wasn't any conflict in America. It was called the consensus school, and they sort of ignored, black people, Native Americans, women, working class people, you know, everybody that didn't fit into the high white success story of the 50s. And there's an element of, I mean, that's where I started, because I started with asking the question, what caused the 60s, the 1960s? What caused people to ask the questions, the really deep questions that challenged the normal American success story. And I looked back and ended up with started with Thoreau. But when you write it, as you say, you can't give away your ending before as you start your story. You've got to tell it as a story the way it happened, which of course is back to front, which is from in terms of time from 1840s say to the 1960s. It's certainly what I tried to do, and I'm as guilty, I suppose, as anybody of, as you say, connecting the dots when you're looking backward. But I really didn't, when I started, I asked that question and I didn't have an answer. And it was years before the answer that I generated came to me. I really didn't.
The question of what caused the 60s?
Yes. And I didn't say, oh, well, it was the relationship of black people and of white people and black music. It was like 3 years before I sort of went, well, wait a minute, what are those big strands? I mean, there are a lot of strands. You can't, no one thing caused the 60s, or dozens of things. But one of them was rock and roll. And this is the ultimate deepest roots of rock and roll, because it does go all the way back to the minstrel era. And to when, to when America started, the America that we know now, started in the early 1800s, when the prosperity and the economy started booming as a result of changes in the banking system, and it became a corporate country. It became a country that instead of large landowners and gentry, had business as the royalty. And it's been that way ever since, of course.
Yeah.
And Thoreau was the first guy that sat down and said, well, okay, this is the way it is. I'm not so sure I like this. And proceeded to write Walden. So there you go.
That's very interesting. Yeah, from what we're saying here, it sounds like this is a very intellectual book, but it's really a fun read for and a page turner for people who like American history or people who like the history of music. And like I said, it's deeply researched, and there's all these great characters in it, and there is like a subtle connection to all of them, which is really fun to sort of get on that ride and see how it all comes together. Dennis McNally is our guest right now. His website is DennisMcNally.com, and the book is On Highway 61, Music, Race, and the Evolution of Cultural Freedom. And I see you've got some bookstore appearances in San Francisco, Sonoma, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. Folks can go to DennisMcNally.com to get the dates and the information on that stuff. Am I right that you wrote, your first book was a biography of Jack Kerouac, and Jerry Garcia read that book and then called you and said, why don't you come work for the Grateful Dead? Is that what happened?
More or less. That's the short version. I'll admit I did send him a copy of the book to the Grateful Dead had a Deadhead's mailing address, and I had no idea whether he'd get it or not. But a very nice lady there made sure he did. And Jerry, grew up in the late '50s in San Francisco with the beat scene, fresh. He was sort of thought of himself as the youngest beatnik. He was the baby beatnik. Huh. And it really made an impression on him. And so he liked what I did with the Kerouac book and said, why don't you do us? Why don't you do the Grateful Dead? And long story short, and a lot of years later, that's what I did with my second book. And then I got to this, and I wanted to look back. And I really appreciate what you said about the characters in it, because, frankly, I had an underlying idea, but history is about people. I mean, the stories, the people that are in the history of American music, they're just amazing people. Ragtime Texas, who was a guy named Henry Thomas, who was a black man who was like hoboing all over America in the 1880s and 90s. And so that when they finally started recording in the late 20s, he was already in his 60s, and he was doing stuff that was written even before the blues. I mean, it's just sort of old African-American pop music. And Dylan and Robert Johnson and John Hammond and, John Lomax, the great song hunter. It's a, it's a, it's a great bunch of people.
Yeah, and you sort of pull out just the right facts. There's not too many or too few, which is tough to do in this kind of thing. And one of the things that the book really did for me was put things into perspective in terms of just the timeline. You know, it's like you don't really realize that jazz literally didn't exist, you know, much more than 100 years ago. You know, zero jazz. You know,
there's this wonderful picture that you probably have seen. There's also a movie that goes with it. And if you haven't seen it, I really urge anybody that's interested in music to see it. It's called Great Day in Harlem. And it is about the taking of a photograph, I want to say 1958, in which they tried to get kind of everybody they could that was famous in jazz to line up and have a picture taken.
Is it from Life Magazine, maybe?
I'm sorry?
Was it Life Magazine originally?
I think it was Esquire, actually. But it was one of the big magazines, and they got a big-time photographer. And, you know, they had maybe 100 guys. Well, in 1958, jazz was 50, maybe 60 years old, which is to say a couple of the originators had died, but most of the great musicians that had played jazz were still alive. And this picture is simply phenomenal. I mean, it was such an amazing art form, and yet really it was so new in 1958. And, you know, so you're absolutely right. This stuff, we think of it as being around forever, but not so.
Yeah, and I forgot that, like, you know, some of the blues guys wrote songs that you think existed, you know, that cavemen wrote or something, but, you know, but they
particularly in the blues tradition, the earliest stuff, there were like 100 lines, you know, there were the moon looks good shining through the trees, and the sun's going to shine on my back door. And they got into 20 songs. You know, they were sort of handed back. And some of the original blues, they aren't formal songs. They're just these fragments, and guys would just sort of play and sing fragments. And it wasn't until they got recorded that they sort of got codified and got, you know, this is a song. And it was only as time went along that people started consciously sitting down and writing a song.
Interesting. Yeah, the country tradition, that sort of folk tradition of just to hand things down and change them a little bit, and you sort of take that all the way through the book as well. One of the things you talk about in the book is how there are sort of cultural revisionists, and people look at this stuff and they do sometimes over-intellectualize it or whatever. Do people then do that to your work? There must be people who disagree with your take on things.
Well, I've seen a few, the book's just barely out, and I've only seen a couple of reviews, and actually, fortunately, they've been rather positive, I am sure, because I criticize some people for what I think is. There's a whole trend now in cultural studies in the academic world to kind of have this theoretical matrix, and you have to wedge everything in to fit the matrix, rather than let the story tell itself. I'm, on that level, I guess you could say I'm very old-fashioned. I want the story to just tell itself, and we see what there is to be seen. Even though I'm doing the selecting, of course, I control the narrative as the writer. But I don't have any big theoretical matrix, and I don't want that to tell the story. I want the events to tell the story. And I'm sure that, you know, there'll be people who just say, oh, well, he's just, you know, old fashioned and out of date and whatever. That's okay.
I assume in your work with the Grateful Dead, you must have met Bob Dylan. They worked together quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And is he out of his mind? Is he on drugs all the time? What is his deal?
Well, he's not on drugs all the time, and he's not out of his mind, but he's not... He pays attention. If you ever get a chance, another great movie, a truly great movie to see, is Don't Look Back, which is the film of him in England on his last solo tour there in 1965.
But he sort of comes off like a jerk in that movie, you know, just an ordinary jerk.
Yes. Well, at this point, he is a man who's writing a brilliant new song a day.
Yeah.
And his mind's exploding. I mean, there's a level of creativity that he had, say, from 1963 to 1966 that's almost unimaginable.
I totally agree.
Those albums, that sheer volume of stuff he put out, so that frankly he was from all accounts, he was probably keeping going on, you know, taking bennies and, you know, speed pills or whatever, And he just, he pushed himself far, far harder than a person can really stand.
A 22-year-old person, too.
It was ridiculous. And yes, he was brutal to people sometimes and awful. And he did the smartest thing in the whole world, which is he had a minor, from all accounts, a minor motorcycle accident. And he made it out to be somewhat more important than it was at that moment. And as a result, he took a good long rest and calmed down and got out of that headspace and survived, because I don't think he would have lived if he tried to keep going the way he was.
It is amazing. You go through those early Dylan albums and you sort of point out about exactly what is mind-blowing. And it is just the sheer volume of incredible songs is great. And people almost, they needed to reinvent the paradigm, because it was what he was doing was so good. But I mean, I just have a theory when you hear him or you read about him that he is, you know, that the pressure society put on him as the spokesman of an entire generation drove him crazy in a little bit.
A little bit, you know. I mean, it certainly sort of defined his life for a few years. And it made him cranky, and particularly with the press, who would do these silly interviews in which they would ask, you know, oh, well, you're the spokesman of the generation, so tell us what the generation wants. And he's like, I'm nobody's spokesman. You know, what he was saying, his answer to one of those was, look, I'm just a song and dance man, you know? I'm just a guy writing a song, trying to play it, trying to stay in tune. He got pushed very hard, both by his manager and by, you know, circumstances and by his own creativity. He was out there for a while.
Well, cranky is a good word. The Beatles sort of found, the Beatles found a great way to sort of deflect that incredible, you know, those press conferences with them. They handle it so well. You know, they managed to turn it around, but in a playful way.
Exactly. Well, again, the Beatles had three other guys.
Yeah, that's
to,
true. Yeah.
To share that world with, and yeah. Bob didn't, and that, there's a big difference there. I mean, I watched it with the Grateful Dead, and, you know, they're the same thing. They had all this fame and all these people thinking that they were, you know, godlike, and they knew perfectly well they weren't, and they spent a lot of time teasing each other and making sure that the other guys did not, you know, take themselves too seriously. And that's a healthy way to approach that. And as a matter of fact, when on those rare occasions when they did press conferences, they reacted just like the Beatles, which is to say they made things funny, which is a much healthier way of approaching it than the kind of mortal combat that Dylan sometimes got into.
Well, it's just hard when you accept, you know, stardom, but then you sort of reject having a press conference. It's just kind of, you know, it's hard to feel too sorry for Bob Dylan. Dennis McNally is our guest. DennisMcNally.com is his website. He's got some book signings coming up, mostly on the West Coast and in Washington, D.C., and the name of the book is On Highway 61, Music, Race, and the Evolution of Cultural Freedom. And I really thought the book was very interesting, and I want to thank you for joining us this morning. It has been fascinating.
I thank you for having me. It's a pleasure, and it's America. It's a great subject.
Yeah, it is. It's endless. I highly recommend the book. Thanks, Dennis. Have a great morning.
Thank you. You too.
Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where you want this killing done? God said, hold on Highway 61. Well, Georgia Sam, he had a bloody nose. Welfare department, they wouldn't give him no clothes. He asked poor Howard, where can I go? Howard said, there's only one place I know. Sam said, tell me quick, man, I got to run. Oh, Howard just pointed with his gun and said, that way down Highway 61. finger said to Louis the King. I got 40 red, white, blue shoestrings and 1,000 telephones that don't ring. Do you know where I can get rid of these things? And Louis the King said, let me think for a minute, son. Then he said, yes, I think it can be easily done. Just take everything down to Highway 61. Now the fifth daughter on the 12th night told her first father that things weren't right. My complexion, she says, is much too white. He said, come here and step into the light. He says, you're right. Let me tell the second mother this has been done. But the second mother was with the seventh son, and they were both out on Highway 61. He was very bored, trying to create a next world war. He found a promoter who nearly fell off the floor. He said, I never engaged in this kind of thing before, but yes, I think it can be very easily done.